Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
All of the world leaders who are participating in the G20 summit have arrived. They are gathering on stage in Buenos Aires. And, you know, it's interesting because we're so focused on Xi Jinping meeting with Donald Trump. But there's a lot of other things going on, including the fact that the U.S., Canada, and Mexico did just sign their new trade deal. And meanwhile, Mexico is about to get its new president. Joining us now, Damian Sassauer, who heads up fixed income emerging markets research for Bloomberg Intelligence. Damian, thank you so much for being with us. I want to start with this agreement that was just signed and talk about its effect on Mexico in particular. Mexico, one of the hottest bets in emerging markets credit land, which has failed again and again and has been struggling. So can you just give us a sense? Are they losing out here? Is it putting Mexico in an even worse position, even with everything else going on politically?
Well, it's interesting because, Mexico has just taken it on the chin, right? And the peso is at some of the weakest levels we've seen in some time. And we happen to like Mexico at these levels, but, you know, there are some real issues. I mean, more domestic than related to trade at this point, I think, that's really kind of, you know, resonating in the eyes and the minds of creditors here in the U.S. And they have more to do with, you know, issues such as fees being charged by banks on households and on depositors, on Pemex, on the airport, which was recently voted down. I mean, these are all issues that have, quite frankly, a much bigger impact on asset valuations than the trade agreement at this point.
Damian, does the security situation in Mexico also have an effect on how investors interpret the potential for investment returns?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Tim. I think sentiment is largely been driven by, much of the, really, the headlines coming out of the White House here in the U.S., right? And so, you know, while you can't really kind of hang your hat on it, yes, there's no question that sentiment's been impacted by that. And security is an issue, right? Because I think AMLO's on the record as saying he does not support a wall and he's not going to fund it.
I can imagine. One other aspect of the G20 meeting, which I find really interesting, is that it is being held in Buenos Aires in Argentina. Argentina, of course, has had a very difficult period of time, after having gone back to capital markets after a long absence, showing that it still is in financial straits. Interestingly, though, the Argentinian currency has actually been doing phenomenally over the past month. What's going on?
Well, I think that's more technical on the heels of the IMF deal. But let me be very clear about this, Lisa. Argentina, and specifically the elections in the second half of next year, are the number one exogenous risk facing emerging market creditors in 2019. Okay? I mean, if we have a return to, I'm not suggesting, Kirchner's going to be reelected, but not a Peronist or something along those lines, which is very probable. I mean, I think the markets are going to perceive that as really a very negative thing, an end to the austerity measures that Mauricio Macri has passed and supports, and that would be really, really bad for Argentina and for its creditors, of which there is no shortage, given the fact that Argentina, despite the sell-off, is still one of the biggest overweights in emerging market portfolios today.
Wait, I want to pick up on something you said. You said that is the biggest exogenous risk facing emerging markets creditors, even more than China?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. Because China is an investment grade issuer, so spreads are not so wide, and the risk of Chinese of credit spreads in China really blowing out, given the size of that economy, is nowhere near that of high yield speculative single B rated Argentina, and Argentina's impact on EM portfolios is, it's amazing. Despite the fact that China is 15% of EM dollar debt, Argentina is not far behind it. Argentina's issued a lot of U.S. dollar debt in the past 3 years. And so, yes, we believe that that has more potential than China to move the needle. Now, that's a direct impact. In terms of an indirect impact, clearly weakness in China and slower growth in China has a knock-on effect to the broader emerging markets, right? So from that perspective, I hear you. But in terms of a direct impact, all eyes are going to be on that election as we head into 2019.
Damien, I was under the impression that a stronger U.S. dollar would actually be better for emerging markets because it would make their commodities more competitive and their products and services more competitive. Is that off the table?
Well, you know, you're hitting on a nerve. I mean, we wrote that exactly to that point this week. We did a deep dive just yesterday on corporate credit fundamentals in emerging markets, and it's amazing what we found. We found that those companies who basically have basically large U.S. dollar denominated inputs have really seen their credit fundamentals weaken here in 2018, which makes sense, right? Because they have to spend more money on whatever it is whatever inputs they need to manufacture whatever it is they're manufacturing or whatever the case may be. As we get into 2019, if we see the dollar begin to weaken, we should see those companies, the fundamentals underlying those companies, turn more supportive. On the flip side, commodity producers whose output is denominated in dollars have done extraordinarily well, and from a fundamental perspective, look as good as they have in some time, and that's including all the large quasi-sovereign oil producers and some of the larger industrial metal producers.
Thanks very much for being with us. Damien Sassauer is our chief emerging markets credit strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. This comes on a day when the G20 meeting opens in Argentina. It's coming after the family photo shoot with all the leaders lining up at the G20 meeting. You're listening to Bloomberg Markets. I'm Pim Fox along with Lisa Abramowitz.
Pim, we talk a lot about how the FANG stocks, or the Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, have such dominance over the entire stock market. Increasingly, these big companies are having a dominance over everything. And joining us now is someone who really talks about the consequences of that. Jonathan Tepper, I'm very pleased to say, is joining us now, founder of Variant Perception in London. He's in San Francisco today. He's also a Bloomberg opinion columnist and author of a new book, The Myth of Capitalism: Monopolies and the Death of Competition. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. You highlight in a recent column, which is an excerpt of your book, that the U.S.'s startup culture is fading and that this is a big problem. Why?
So what's interesting is over the last 20 years, we've seen a rise in industrial concentration across the board, and that means that there are fewer and fewer players in particular industries, and it's not just the FANGs, it's actually economy-wide. And so if you look at the 20 years ago, we had twice as many public stocks, so there's been a collapse in listings in the stock market. We've also seen essentially a collapse in startups, even including non-public companies. So every year, companies die or exit markets, and when you have a collapse in startups, obviously, if this were happening with the population in the U.S., we'd be deeply alarmed, and this would be dire for the future. But that's what's happening effectively in business. And so, what's happening is that there are a few much bigger companies that now dominate a lot of industries. The book, The Myth of Capitalism, touches on the FANGs, but this is actually happening in many other industries as well. And so, it's a broad-based trend in the U.S. economy.
What is your theory for why this is happening?
So the main reason is that it goes back to 1982 when Reagan changed the merger guidelines, the Department of Justice and the FTC, and basically mergers were given green lights. And when every single stock market boom that we've had has created a merger wave. So we're now sitting here chatting in 2018, and we're essentially four merger waves in. And if you think about it, like the Sweet 16 or the World Cup, you start with 16 players, get down to 8, then to 4, then to 2. And so what's happened is we've just had, competitor after competitor being eliminated. And so, something like the U.S. beer market, now two companies control 90% of the beer Americans drink. And that's totally contrary to the antitrust laws like the Sherman Act, Clayton Act. And so essentially it's this wave of mergers and eliminating competition.
Jonathan, there's an argument that the larger that a company is, the more efficient they can be, and they can actually offer lower prices to the consumer, which is a net win. Why is it a problem for there to be so much more concentration at the top?
Sure. So that's the argument that's offered. Certainly when mergers are about to go through, they hire K Street law firms and then economists for hire, generally like Charles Rivers Associate and Compass Lexicon. But the evidence is overwhelming that reducing the number of players actually leads to price increases. So, it's like New Year's resolutions. Companies, say that they're going to get these synergies and they're going to pass them on to consumers. And as soon as the food shows up, they, decide to break the New Year resolution. And the book goes into sort of dozens of studies where that's the case. Unfortunately, I think that the FTC and DOJ are do-nothing institutions and essentially broadly captured by the revolving door. And so there's no real challenge to mergers, and you just end up with higher prices. The more concentrated the industry in the U.S., generally the higher the price.
So, Jonathan, if that's the case, what's the recipe for changing this?
Certainly. So simply analyzing the problem wouldn't be terribly helpful. The last chapter in the book has some of these proposals, but basically the sort of short answer is, one, prevent further concentration, meaning that we shouldn't allow mergers that reduce competition materially. There's research pointing out that when you get below six players, prices tend to go up. And so I would say that, if an industry is below six players, let them compete. Don't let them merge. I would also say that we have to break up previous mergers that have reduced competition. The world didn't end when Standard Oil was broken up, or AT&T. The world won't end when we break up current monopolies. The other aspect I think that's very important is that regulation tends to act as a very strong barrier to entry. And unfortunately, what we have in the United States right now is not too much or too little regulation, but regulation essentially that serves the interests of companies that want to keep out competitors. So we definitely need sort of better, more principles-based regulation that has competition and new entrants as its key objective.
I have to wonder what kind of responses you've gotten so far to this, because it seems like there are a number of people talking about this now and probably more than, say, 10 years ago. Is that a correct statement?
Absolutely, and I think that this has really started basically, at least entering the public consciousness, probably about 2 years ago. I think that, unsurprisingly, it was sort of at the end, essentially, of a fourth merger wave. 2015 was a peak in mergers for the U.S. 2017 and 18 broadly globally have been peaks, but clearly people are now realizing that there's just a lot less competition. The reaction has been overwhelmingly positive. The people who've endorsed the book and sort of praise the message of the book have been Nobel Prize winners like Terence Deaton, Mike Spence, and then economists like Kenneth Rogoff and historians like Neil Ferguson. So I think this is a very big subject. When I talk to people, at book events or, just sitting at the airport randomly chatting with people, everyone recognizes their own industry as having less competition, sitting next to someone who works in hospitals. 90% of U.S. Hospital markets are highly concentrated. So it resonates in people's lives.
I have to wonder, because we also had Tim Wu on, the Columbia professor recently, who was talking about a similar type of idea. What kind of hope do you have that the current political establishment could potentially enact some measure that would be appropriate here, in your opinion?
So I think that the tide is changing, and I did some book events in D.C. and got to meet quite a lot of people on the Hill, and very definitely senators want to do something about this. You have Warren, Warner, Cory Booker, Klobuchar, and others, and even the Republicans, who often have been perhaps more friendly to big business than not, are realizing that actually if you care about competition and you care about free markets and you're pro-capitalism, what you should want is to reduce industrial concentration, to more competition. So I think this is becoming essentially a bipartisan issue, I certainly do hope that we'll get some change.
Thanks very much for being with us. Jonathan Tepper is the founder of Variant Perception. He is also a Bloomberg Opinion columnist, and his latest book is entitled The Myth of Capitalism, Monopolies, and the Death of Competition. Just yesterday, the California Public Utilities Commission met in order to try to figure out what is next for the top utility in the state of California. That is PG&E. And here to tell us more is Mark Chediak of Bloomberg News. You can follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Chediak. That's Chediak. Mark, just give us a little background as to why P&G is in the focus of regulators related to the recent wildfires.
Hi, yes. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. So PG&E is California's largest utility. It's been operating in California for more than 100 years, but it has, within the last 10 to 15 years, quite a checkered past in the state. It was responsible for a natural gas pipeline explosion in 2010 in a San Francisco suburb that killed 8 people and leveled a neighborhood. Its power lines are have been identified as starting many of last year's deadly wine country fires in Northern California last year. And just recently, investigators are looking at its power lines for starting the Camp Fire, which is now considered the most destructive and deadliest fire in California's history. So as you mentioned yesterday, California's top energy regulator is questioning basically whether or not the company actually has the safety culture and structure in place to deliver safe and reliable electricity in the state.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that this raises a lot of questions, right? I mean, is this just sort of a cost of doing business for any utility, or is this some kind of rampant negligence that's endemic at the utility? And then there's a question, too, what are you going to do, put them out of business? Who's going to take over? So how are people sort of addressing both of those questions?
Yeah, that's a great point. And Michael Picker, who's the president of the California Public Utilities Commission, he basically spoke to that specifically. What he said yesterday is he noted this is, you know, a utility that people depend on for reliable electricity, so you can't just put them out of business. He talked about fixing or changing PG&E as akin to trying to fix an aircraft in flight. He said, you know, we don't want to crash the plane, so we have to be very careful and very deliberative about how we do this.
What is the potential liability for PG&E, or has that not even been figured out?
Well, first of all, let me make it clear that they haven't determined the cause of this year's Camp Fire. So PG&E's power lines are being looked at, but no final determination has been made. If the company is found liable, analysts think it could be around $15 billion. That surpasses PG&E's market cap right now. PG&E is also looking at about $15 billion or more of liability from last year's fire. So that's about $30 billion in liabilities that far exceeds the company's market capitalization. So what's happening now is state officials are looking at ways in which they can potentially help the utility pay off these massive liabilities. They don't really want the company to go bankrupt. That's kind of a worst-case scenario. But they also don't want the public very much doesn't want the utility to get off scot-free either.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a chance of, quote, no bailout, as you wrote in your latest story. I have to wonder, at this point, can they break the company up? Can they give some kind of advantage to competing utilities to try to gain share? I mean, what are sort of some of the ways that they could solve this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, state officials are really taking a hard look at this. Some of the options being considered, one, the top energy regulator, Michael Picker, said there could be changes at the company's board. There's some board members who have been with the company for quite a long time. So you could see something like that. The company has an electric distribution service and also a natural gas distribution service. You could see them breaking up those two pieces of the company. You could even see them breaking up PG&E into smaller sort of regional divisions. So there are a number of potential options. Nothing has been suggested. There have been no firm suggestions at this point.
Mark Chediak, thank you so much for being with us. Mark Chediak is an energy reporter for Bloomberg News, coming to us from San Francisco. Really interesting to think about. Too big to fail in the context of utilities, especially when you do have, Pim, a pattern, frankly, here with PG&E, although, of course, it does have to be established what their role was in the campfires. But really, potentially this could be a real big problem for California.
Well, it could be. Yes, PG&E's market cap right now is just a little bit more than $13.5 billion, and it has dropped by more than 40% this year.
Yeah, it's been a really rough year for them, and frankly, for all Californians who are thinking, "What are we going to do with them?" And we don't want to bail them out.
Joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio is Joe Mysak, editor for the Bloomberg Brief for Municipal Markets. Joe Mysak, let's begin with General Motors and the announcement this week that they will be exiting a variety of locations. They are shuttering a total of 5 plants, one of them going to be in Canada. What effect is this going to have on municipal finances?
Well, you know, whenever you and something, most of these plants are in the they're in the upper Midwest, Ohio and Michigan, of course, one in Canada. You know, there is an outsized effect in some of these small communities where, you know, these, particularly Amanda Albright did a story this week about Lordstown, Ohio. Small town, has a factory in it that GM wants to shut. And that is going to have an outsized impact because of the village there is 3,300 people. And, you know, this has a knock-on effect. You know, when you say, here we're closing down and we're getting rid of, you know, several hundred people, several thousand people, there are stores that are going to have, there's going to be an impact there, and the housing market's going to be impacted, schools. So, yeah, this is, it's tough when you have a company come in and say, we're going to close down. And, of course, you know, maybe some of it is, you know, a bargaining chip. We say we're shutting down 6 firms or we're shutting down 6 factories, and you really have to shut down maybe one.
Well, just according to the story, if you look at the total employment in, just as this example, Lordstown, you're talking about 5% of the total county employment. How do you make up something like that?
It's very difficult, especially because in these upper Midwest communities, you don't have a lot of, it's not the same as in the South where you have a lot of factories that are, you know, going to be moving in or want to move in. So when you have one of these long time employers decide that, well, that's it, see ya, it's very difficult to make that up.
And this has been really the story of a lot of the Rust Belt, the so-called Rust Belt, right? I mean, this is sort of, we're watching it in real time, sort of as it plays out near the end of this whole thing, or maybe we're in the middle, I don't know. But it's really interesting to think about how that affects municipalities. On a brighter note, though, for municipalities right now, there was a bond rally that was inclusive of municipal bonds after Jay Powell of the Fed spoke. People seem to want to come back to the debt, because it seems like the Fed's not going to hike rates as quickly. How sustainable is the rally that we saw, the sort of knee-jerk money into the record flow into BlackRock's ETF, muni bond ETF, and sort of the initial jolt there?
Well, it's funny. The thing we talked about earlier this summer about so many bonds being, you know, going to mature and so many bonds being called away, money looking for a new home, we're setting up for that again in December, January. These are the months where people get money back and have to reinvest it. And the supply, I would say we're probably going to get a little boomlet in December, but it's not going to overwhelm the money that's looking for a new home. So that is very constructive. You know, that is one of those factors in the muni market. See it in December, January, and then see it in June and July.
What's the likelihood they're going to have to increase rates in order to entice buyers? Not very much.
Not much. You know, wow. You know, when you take a look at the 10-year bond, the yield has dropped back down. I mean, I thought for a while we might hit 3% on it. Nah, not going to. And you know, as I say, this boomlet in supply.
I mean, the only place you can go for 3% is Pennsylvania, yeah, for the 10-year.
The boomlet in supply is not going to result in everybody you know, all of a sudden coming in and saying, well, we have to pay more money to attract investors.
Well, one place that might have to pay more money is Puerto Rico, because there is some talk that they might be returning to the municipal bond market at some point. How realistic is that at this point?
Oh, I saw that that deal on the calendar, and that's actually the exchange bonds for the Government Development Bank, the restructuring deal that has been set up. So it's not quite a new issue where they're coming in and saying, oh, we're going to sell all new bonds, step right up. How likely is that right now? I guess at some point next year we'll probably see Puerto Rico weigh in and say, well, here's a new bond issue, but gosh, who knows how much they'd have to pay in yield there.
Joe, is there any estimate just quickly on how much of an effect the fact that banks are not going to be buying and have actually been shedding municipal bonds from their portfolios?
Well, as you can see, not much. You know, the yields have been coming down. We had a little bit of an impact, and that was purely the Fed, and rates moved higher, and just they're kind of swooning again. You know, an interesting thing I just want to toss in, the unrated bond market is up about 20% this year in munis.
Interesting. Search for yield. I imagine it yields a little bit more and it's a little bit less liquid. Joe Mysak, editor of the Bloomberg Brief, focused on the municipal bond market for Bloomberg News. Thank you so much for being with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking about luxury and how the concept of luxury is changing ahead of this holiday season. I'm Lisa Abramowitz along with Pim Fox, and this is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.